Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Do hope you're enjoying your Saturday afternoon. I'm Justin Briley with you through till 4 o'clock this afternoon on Unbelievable. I do hope you're enjoying the start of August. And if you're away on holidays and you're missing any of the programmes, don't forget you can listen online as well. They're all there in an archive, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Well, my thanks to Megan for iChoose, and she is a fabulous young lady and brings us a fabulous selection of tunes every week, doesn't she? So she'll be back again at the same time next week. And don't forget Dave and B here with Hip Rock UK also between 4 and 6 this afternoon. That's what's happening later. What happening right now, I hear you ask?
You're unbelievable.
Well, we are taking a break from the current series on American Masters of Apologetics to have a discussion on faith schools, particularly in, if you like, the publicly funded sector. So we're talking particularly today about Church of England schools, and Andrew Copson, the education officer for the British Humanist Association, joins us. He's against the whole idea of a place of education where we start bringing a particular faith view into focus over and against any other view. Jan Ainsworth is the education officer for the Church of England. She'll be explaining their methodology and why she believes that bringing children up in an environment of education and Christian faith is a good idea. That's on the programme today. Do hope you can stay with me through till 4 o'clock. Well, time to look at some of your response to the last few weeks of programming. As I say, the last 3 weeks have been taken up with American Masters of Apologetics. Last week, we had Alvin Plantinger, of course. He's really in his field. He is a very eminent philosopher, a Christian philosopher. Nick Priest wanted to say how interesting this current set of programs are. It's certainly somewhat more relaxed than some of the debate programs. Perhaps surprisingly, though, no less interesting, but hugely informative. Many thanks for a great programme. And also thanks for the opportunity to download and listen later on the iPod. That's excellent. Thank you, Nick, for listening. It's been great to have your comments. Got this one from Sam Nico, responding to the programme of a couple of weeks ago where we had William Lane Craig joining us. Sam says, I was interested in your comments concerning an email you read in which you argued a case for apologetics, but on the programme with William Lane Craig, I felt myself siding with the email. In the course of the programme, there was a short piece about the other Gospels, not part of the New Testament. Some of these are highly philosophical, while some have little to offer with regard to a spiritual or inner sense. But as As the programme continued, here we were discussing Leibniz, first causes and the usual arguments with a smattering of modern science, all doing what precisely? Not much different, it seems, than those Gospels. The danger is that modern ideas tend to come and go like fashions, and if Christianity or spirituality in general is allied to such reasoning, it also falls prey to the fashions of the time. It seems to me that there is a real problem of emphasis. The first and most fundamental point is the heart of spirituality that stems from the nature of divine love. Everything after that is secondary, and there is a danger that secondary features are taking pride of place. Thank you very much, Sam, for your views. I do hope it won't stop you listening, though, to a programme which ultimately is, yes, in a sense, about that secondary aspect of how we can, you know, beyond just faith, if you like, a spiritual encounter in the Bible, how we believe we can justify the reasons for our belief. But Anna Pregner, another regular email now from Anna, who says she's listening again to the programme on Is Islam Relevant to the 21st Century? And you've come to the conclusion that Muslims are doing what they do best, playing the victim, with four exclamation marks after it. One more thing, Islam may liberate the way of life, but it will enslave the spirit and will not give you the assurance of salvation that we need. Thank you, Anna, for your responses. And don't forget, you can respond to today's programme as well by the usual methods. That's premier.org. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. And you can do it by telephone. Leave me a voicemail message, 08456 52 52 52, and select option 5. Well, we'll be meeting our guests shortly, and we'll also be hearing from John Twistleton as he brings us another frequently asked question. But I just want to make you aware of something that's available on the Premier website. I was recently involved in producing a TV documentary on the whole issue of homosexuality in the Anglican Church. It's a big one, and it's all come to a head, rather, with the latest Lambeth Conference. And in light of the Lambeth Conference, I was involved in producing a documentary that you can watch now at the premier.org.uk site. You can find it by going to premier.org.uk/Lambeth and clicking on the video there featuring Gene Robinson. He, of course, is a controversial character, ordained 5 years ago in the Anglican Church as a bishop. He is the first openly homosexual bishop in the Anglican Church. And you can watch this programme. Here's just a short extract from it, just to whet your appetite to some of the issues going on. In this instance, a discussion that features John Richardson of the Anglican Evangelical Group Reform, and of course Bishop Gene Robinson as well, on the issue of homosexuality and whether the Bible condones it or not.
But then, of course, there is always forgiveness. So 1 Corinthians 6, Paul lists things which will count you out of the kingdom, including homosexual practice, but also including other things, anger and so on. And then he says at the end of this, such were some of you, but you were washed, but you were cleansed, but you were sanctified, and so on. There is always redemption. We're all sinners. This is a manifestation of sin. Christ died for sinners. It's the same trajectory. The American Episcopal Church were told, if you go ahead with this, it will cause a rift. They said, fine, and went ahead with it. So, again, objectively, you have to say now, whose fault is the rift that now exists?
Bishop Gene Robinson disagrees. He claims that writings such as the Apostle Paul's on homosexuality need to be understood in the context and language of their time.
Well, St. Paul uses two words, and it describes a practice known to Paul in Greek and Roman culture, where an older man would take an adolescent boy under his wing, so to speak, and teach him about society, about becoming a man, and use him sexually. You and I would call that child abuse, and no one, no responsible person is arguing for that, certainly not myself. And so when those two words, which indicate the older man and the younger adolescent being used, when that gets translated as homosexuals, it distorts what's being talked about here. So it is certainly a negative in Paul's writings, but I would be negative about it as well. What I'm saying is that when Scripture makes reference to this, they're not talking about mutual, lifelong, intentioned, committed relationships among equal adults, which is what we're talking about today.
those who support a traditional reading of Scripture are simply not convinced by these kinds of arguments.
Well, we know from looking at the literature of the time that a whole range of relationships existed amongst people, same-sex relationships existed. One was the category that Gene Robinson is talking about, but that was a relationship which belonged to the aristocracy. It was very tightly regulated. It was actually quite asexual in terms of what was done. And therefore, to categorise it and equate it to modern child abuse is simply not to understand what was going on then. Paul's society, Paul's age, were very familiar with same-sex relationships. And although they hadn't reached the point we have of having civil partnerships endorsed by the state and having a whole programme to normalise these things, there was a tacit understanding that these things happened, and it was to that Paul was writing. So the differences are not there. I mean, simply if you read the history of the time, these differences aren't there. And I just think Gene Robinson and those that try and make that argument are covering up the actual case, the actual situation.
Well, there you are. Just a short selection of the kind of stuff you'll see on that particular documentary. Do go and watch it at premier.org.uk/Lambeth. It'll give you a real good overview, a balanced one as well, with both sides, if you like, featured in it, of the issues at play in the Anglican Church currently on the issue of homosexuality. Well, we're going to be meeting our guests shortly. We've got with us two people looking at education and whether faith should be part of the mix. They are Andrew Copson and Jan Ainsworth. They're with me shortly. But first of all, John Twistleton here, as we look at another frequently asked question.
Frequently Asked Questions with John Twistleton.
How can a loving God condemn people to hell? The idea of a loving God taking pleasure in people being tormented in hell is hard to swallow. Yet the founder of Christianity himself spoke much of hell. Jesus did so especially when he warned religious leaders against hypocrisy and rich people against indifference to the poor. Because Christians see Jesus as the Son of God, they're bound to his teaching. This includes the reality of people finally excluded from God in a place of desolation. Some Christians today doubt the existence of hell. They claim Jesus died for the sins of the whole world, and so everyone will be saved. So-called universalism denies people the right to respond to the good news. It also denies what Jesus actually teaches. For example, in Matthew chapter 25, he speaks of the separation at the end time of sheep and goats, of those inheriting God's kingdom as against those departing to destruction. In the story of the rich man and Lazarus, the poor man, Christ paints a picture of a great gulf fixed between heaven and hell. Would Jesus have taught this and spoken so much of the urgent need to choose the right path by repenting and believing in God if that were unnecessary? How, though, can a loving God revealed in Jesus Christ condemn people to hell? There's a continual emphasis in Scripture on two courses for human beings. The way of righteousness leads to heavenly glory. The way of selfishness leads to eternal darkness. Even if wickedness sometimes appears to triumph on earth, the doctrines of heaven and hell affirm God will ultimately have his way, with us or without us. People determined to go their own way are respected by their Creator. His love for them is so pure that he won't manipulate them away from hell. Those who see themselves as self-made men and women should be able to worship their perceived Creator forever in that darkness. Any discussion about hell leads back to the whole purpose of this life, in relation to the world to come, especially whether there is a world to come, and how you best prepare for it. Cardinal Newman wrote 150 years ago that life is short, death is certain, and the world to come is everlasting. In Britain today, life is not so short, thanks to medicine. The certainty of death is edited out of public life, except through the pictures of conflict abroad, often brought to our television screens. This, although death and taxation are still jokingly referred to as the only certainties in life. Is there a greater certainty than death? Is there someone who has overcome the power of death and has the capacity to offer life without end? These are the questions for Christians to raise when people want to dismiss hell. The soul is eternal. As darkness and light can't exist together, so the eternal place of the soul that hasn't been cleansed or redeemed by God simply cannot be with him. God is holy and can have no fellowship with what is unholy. Uncleansed souls need to be separated from God in their eternal state. This is what we mean by hell. How about the images Jesus uses of eternal fire, crying and grinding of teeth, a place of continual decay, and deepest darkness? Well, they're just images. Hell isn't a place like the earth, but an eternal state outside time and space for those excluded from God's presence. To be in such a state is dreadful. But Scripture makes plain it's dreadful to God himself, who sent Jesus not to judge the world, but to save it. God our Saviour desires all to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth, we read in 1 Timothy 2. How can a loving God condemn people to hell? God is bound by his nature, which is both holy and loving, and this nature can't be changed. Do all Christians escape hell? God promises heaven to believers as a free gift, but he also calls them to persevere in faith. Perseverance is therefore part of the recipe for gaining heaven and escaping hell. God's love is perfect, and he desires our love. He also respects the free will of everyone, and their choice to turn their back on him in this world and the next. Heaven is the place of God's ultimate presence, and God won't compel unwilling people to be at his side forever.
If you have any difficult questions about the Christian faith, or have your own answer for the frequently asked question we looked at today, please visit www.premier.org.uk/FAQ to contribute to the programme.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I wonder what your school was like when you were growing up. Perhaps you still are at that stage in your life. I do hope that you'll find today's discussion of interest. We're looking at the whole issue of faith schools and the place of faith in a child's life. Should it be in the public domain? Should it be in the private domain? What about schools that do have a Christian ethos to their education? Well, we've got two people here who already know each other, actually. Certainly not the first time they've met. They are Andrew Copson and the Reverend Jan Ainsworth. Andrew is the Education Officer for the British Humanist Association, and the Reverend Jan Ainsworth, the Church of England's Chief Education Officer. So they both know what they're talking about when it comes to this sort of thing, or at least they claim to, and I'm sure we'll find out in the course of the programme. Thank you so much for joining me, both of you, on the programme today. I thought it might be fun to start off with, just to ask you both what your experiences were of school. Firstly, Andrew, did you grow up in a religious sort of school, or not at all?
No, not at all. My primary school, when I was very little, was a community school. I came from a very diverse sort of post-industrial area, so the community school had children from all sort of different backgrounds, religions, I suppose, not that we thought about it at that age, ethnicities and so on. And then for my secondary school, I went to a secular independent school where we did study about religions and also non-religious philosophies, and we did have assemblies that sometimes were about religious stories, but there was no religious worship in any of my schooling, or no religious education in terms of instruction in a certain religion, and I think that was very enjoyable and fulfilling for me.
And you never sort of had friends who said, oh, don't you do prayers in the morning at your school or anything? Did you have any friends who went to other types of school, or was that sort of what you knew and what you accepted?
Yeah, there weren't any faith schools actually in the area where I grew up, any primary schools. because a lot of the schools were new from when, I suppose, community comprehensives were being opened. I did have some friends who went to a Sunday school, different, obviously, and I did actually go to Sunday school for a little while, quite against the wishes of my mother, I think, who wasn't very keen on that sort of thing, but did drive me to Sunday school every week for about a year. But I didn't really enjoy it. I won a scripture prize.
Well,
yeah.
Can you still recall any of the memory verses you had to?
No, I think all I had to do is colour in a picture of Ruth. So I sort of remember. I remember the story of Ruth. But even then, I found the story of Ruth not nearly as interesting as the story of sort of Hercules and Perseus and so on and the Greek myths we were doing at school. So I think that probably is why it didn't last long. I soon finished at Sunday school.
And so the impact of that. Part of your life was not great, and really you've never really considered seriously faith as an option in your worldview.
Well, I mean, I've considered it, of course, seriously, and had lots of long, deep into the night conversations with religious friends and so on at university and after. But it's never really appealed to me. I don't know whether that's. I suppose in a way that might be because my early education never really touched upon it. I mean, I was aware of it as an option for some people, and obviously aware of it as something that some people believed. But I think you have to be immersed in a worldview pretty early on in your life, I think, if it's going to be long-lasting for you. And I wasn't in a religious worldview at all.
Jan, what was your school setting when you were growing up?
Well, interestingly, quite similar. I went to an ordinary county primary school, which was catching up with the city. The city was catching up with where we lived, but it still thought of itself as a village school. And I suppose was fairly typical of the day, because the system we have does have legal requirements for worship and religious education, and for us that was within a fairly kind of straightforward and standard Christian context. There was no real depth to it, no real questioning of it, but I do remember vividly that singing hymns from Songs of Praise had a great impact. I mean, singing's always been very powerful for me, and that's certainly something that stayed with me. And I could still sing you some of the ones we sang, which were totally unsuitable. One of the favourites of the headmaster was "Here in the Country's Heart Where the Grass is Green." Well, we weren't actually in the country's heart, but it still created a kind of picture, I think, of what he hoped the school was like. So that was a kind of gentle Christian framework. I don't remember any religious education at primary school, but Sunday school certainly was. And I was just thinking when Andrew was saying, it's a shame that actually we do present a kind of sanitised version of the biblical record to children, because there's some cracking stories in the Bible. But actually we don't like them, because they're all about low cunning and bloodthirstiness and guts and gore. So maybe we should do more of that. My secondary school, and this will reveal to your listeners how old I am, was a direct grant school. So I went on a scholarship, whereas there were both fee-paying and scholarship girls there in the middle of Nottingham. And again, it was a kind of basically a kind of secular school, but with a very powerful religious education teacher, and she had a very strong influence on me, wouldn't allow us to do GCE as it was in the time, because she said it was boring. So we really only encountered proper study of religion, which was at sixth form stage, Christianity. We did Bible papers in a very rigorous and demanding way, and that appealed to me. That, I suppose, took me over the hump in teenage years from seeing religion as, you know, something you just had to believe things other people told you, to something that you could get your own brain round and do your own thinking round. So that was a kind of fairly critical point for me. And I read religious studies at college and then afterwards as well. So it was very much a kind of engagement of the brain as much as it being part of life.
Were you brought up in a Christian sort of context outside school?
Yes, there was an expectation that we went to church. I always used to think that we were the kind of my mother's insurance policy. We were a reasonably large family, so she sent us off to church while she was doing what she needed to do on Sunday. But again, it was the choir that held me. And also, I suppose, even in those days, feeling the power of Anglican liturgy, even though it was very badly done and very kind of boringly done, that sense of something that continues and holds you, whatever you're feeling like, you know, whatever you take into it, that's there, and it's been there for years, and it's been the way in which people have prayed and encountered God. So something of that. My sisters rang the bells, which I don't think had quite the same effect. They'd probably be banned these days, wouldn't they?
Well, thank you for giving us a little insight into your educational upbringings. I did actually attend a Church of England primary school, so I'm the only one here who appears had the benefit, or not so benefit, as you may see it, Andrew, of that particular upbringing. Though that obviously, I mean, I've always said myself that I don't think I was particularly influenced towards Christianity. I could hardly describe it as you know, an influence in my faith journey in a very obvious way. Through primary school, or indeed the secondary school, which was also had a, you know, a Christian ethos, if not being a specifically Church of England school. But I'm sure that there was obviously influences there that you probably can't exactly put your finger on, but which are just part of the general milieu of your growing up years. And we, if you're listening and you'd like to comment, we're going to be discussing the whole thorny issue of faith schools this afternoon, and we'd love your input as well. You can get in touch by phone 08456 52 52 52. Select option 5 to leave me a voicemail message, and I'll happily play it out next week and indeed pass on any relevant ones to our guests here in the studio. And you can also email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We're going to be asking, is an act of religious worship important in the running of a school? Should faith be the responsibility of parents rather than the educational establishment? And what about selecting school children on the basis of their faith? Is that discriminatory? These and many other subjects we'll be attempting to get our head around in the course of the programme today. As I say, my guest today, Andrew Copson, he's the education officer for the British Humanist Association, and obviously they campaign for secular standards in terms of schooling. They don't believe that religion should play a part in the upbringing of a child in the educational sphere, if you like. The Reverend Jan Ainsworth is the Church of England's Chief Education Officer, and she, of course, is fully in support of the religious atmosphere in a Church of England school, and she believes that that helps in the various ways for children as they're growing up. And we'll find out why specifically as we continue on the programme this afternoon. Do join us again in just a couple of minutes.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a $10,000 matching grant that will double your gift today. And right now, that's an incredible blessing, as we're needing $65,000 before the end of the financial year on June 30th. This show depends on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to meet this $65,000 need, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you. I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a $10,000 matching grant that will double your gift today. And right now, that's an incredible blessing, as we're needing $65,000 before the end of the financial year on June 30th. This show depends on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to meet this $65,000 need, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
This is the show where Christians and non-Christians come together to discuss issues that are relevant to modern-day life, and education certainly one of those. It is, of course, approaching the beginning of the new school term. I wonder if you're having thoughts about where your child might be going as far as their future education is concerned. That's something that my wife and I are considering at the moment. We've got a three-year-old, and, of course, questions of which school is appropriate for that child. is of course, a big priority for many parents. Well, we've got two people with very different ideas about what schooling should constitute here in the studio. Andrew Copson is the Education Officer for the British Humanist Association, and he's against the whole idea of faith schools. Reverend Jan Ainsworth is the Church of England's Chief Education Officer, and she's going to be telling us about what she believes are the inherent benefits of marrying faith and education together. This is the discussion we're having on Unbelievable this afternoon between now and 4 o'clock. Well, maybe just to get things going a bit, I can put in this little statement to see what we make of it. This was a part of a petition recently that was doing the rounds on some emails in regard to faith schools, and you'll immediately see where it's coming from. This is what this statement said. Faith schools remove the rights of children to choose their own religious, philosophical and ethical beliefs. They also sanction ethnic segregation and create tension and divisiveness within society. Schools should be places where children are given a free education, not centres for indoctrination. Creationism and other religious myths should not be taught as fact, regardless of the funding status of a school. Abolishing faith schools will provide children with more freedom of choice and help to promote a fully multicultural, peaceful society. Well, Janet, it sounds like you're in the wrong job then, because it's a pretty damning statement. But what was your initial reaction to that kind of a bag of criticisms?
There's so much wrong with that quotation that we could spend the whole programme looking at some of those. But let's just go back to first principles. One is the legal status, and one of the rights enshrined in the European Code is that parents have a right to have their children educated in a place which respects and reflects their own religious and philosophical beliefs. Now, how that works out in different European countries is different. There are different ways of doing that. But in this country, that means there is therefore the option of being able to find schools which reflect your own religious and philosophical beliefs. So that's the first thing. That right is actually enshrined in law for parents. The second is that in English law, again, there is a long tradition of children of a way of looking at children's rights and the status of children, and when they assume rights in some senses varies in according to different aspects of life. But it's quite clearly understood that for a certain period of time, at least, children are not adult enough, not rational enough, not developed enough to make the kinds of decisions, fundamental decisions about their own ways of living. So that's why parents bring children up. That's why schools are in loco parentis, that they actually exercise that duty of care over children. Now, this one's quite an interesting one, because what it's saying is that children's rights trump parents' rights. So a child's right to be treated as a tabula rasa, though, so nobody must tell them anything, so that in the end they make their own choices, trumps any right of a parent and a culture actually to pass on the things that matter to them to the next generation. I mean, that's a clear role of schools anyway, to pass on what is believed to be culturally valuable to the next generation. So it's again, both legally and by custom in this country, we understand that children are taught things, and it's from what they are taught that they then, as they grow older, form their own set of beliefs.
So when this statement says that schools shouldn't be centres for indoctrination.
All right, now that I agree with, absolutely. And one of the things that schools should be doing very clearly is also teaching children the skills of discernment, of understanding argument, of analysis, of being able to hold things up to scrutiny, not so that they're not actually subject to somebody else telling them what to do all the time, and have so they develop the ways of working out for themselves. And that, as they grow older, that means they will put what their parents want for them, put what they've learned in various places, including school, what they get from the external society through the media, through television, and they will be able to work with that. So I'm absolutely against indoctrination, but one of the things that you do if you remove faith from the school context is indoctrinate the other way. You're almost saying to the child, this is not important and you shouldn't consider it important. It's not important enough for us to take any notice of it in school. Therefore, you know, we'll just leave it to anybody else. And in fact, you make children more vulnerable to extremism within faith, to fundamentalism within faith.
So there's no such thing, in a sense, as a neutral upbringing.
No, absolutely not. And that's what that quotation betrays, the idea, the belief that there is a neutral context. Well, there isn't. No school, no community is neutral. Everyone has decided what values are important and how it will organise itself. And if you like, therefore, every community and grouping, including schools, are indoctrinating in some way. And I've just told you some of the things that I should think should be indoctrinated. The importance of argument, the importance of discovery, of working things out for yourself.
But you don't need a religious framework for that, do you, Andrew? I mean, that's presumably what you would say.
No, emphatically not. You don't need a religious framework and to teach skills of discernment and critical thinking and so on. Of course, a religious framework is not at all necessary. I think that I'd take up two points. One, this idea of the neutral objective school being an impossibility, and the other one, the rights question, the question of parents and children's rights. I think it's a sleight of hand to say that if you're against faith schools, you're against any faith in schools. I mean, what this petition is saying is that they're against faith schools. Now, what makes one of the things that makes faith schools, state-funded faith schools, different from state-funded community schools is the fact, for example, that in their religious education lessons, they don't have to follow the agreed syllabus that community schools follow, which is generally more and more broad, balanced, and objective, not perfect, but getting there in some instances. They follow a syllabus of their own. Now, in some cases, and this is where we encounter the vast diversity of different state-funded religious schools, you know, Church of England schools different from Jewish schools, which are different from Catholic schools, which are different from each other, and so on and so forth. But in some faith schools, clearly, that right to decide your own syllabus is going to lead to an unbalanced curriculum. And I think that far from children having no information about religions, as Jan suggests someone who takes a secular view might want, and far from a child having information just about one religion, I would want them to have a broad and balanced and objective education about all sorts of different religious and non-religious worldviews. You know, I don't want to close religious worldviews off from children in school. I want to open them up to them so that they can explore them and learn about them and exercise those skills of discernment in practice by studying these different beliefs and values that people in the world today have. And I think the people who are against faith schools are generally in favour of that sort of broad and balanced approach, an approach that doesn't eliminate discussion of any religious issue from the classroom and from the school. Of course not. We see how badly that works in France and America. But a view that opens up discussion of religion and religious questions and other non-religious philosophical questions in the classroom. So I think it's not true, in sort of summary of that, I think it's not true to say that if you're against faith schools, you're against faith in schools. And on the rights question, parents do have a right, of course, to have their children educated in the manner which they require, but that doesn't mean that the state has to fund those schools. And I think
now we're getting onto money.
Yeah, and I think that's not. I mean, I accept, because I have to, that if parents want to come together and set up an independent school of their own, where they will educate their children that the world was created in 6 days, and that will be the substance of the science exam that they do, and so on, which happens in this country, and you know is permitted, then there's some extent to which you have to say, fine, you know, to interfere in a parent's fundamental rights in that area is so invidious and so dangerous and such a slippery slope that actually we have to consign those children to that fate. But as I say, a parent's right doesn't mean a right to state funding, and we should look to the needs of the
community. I think this is where we fundamentally disagree, because I think it does entitle them to state funding, because after all, those parents are paying taxes in exactly the same way that everybody else is. I mean, the Netherlands certainly has that view, that if there are enough parents of a particular persuasion who want a school, and they can demonstrate that there are enough and they can fill the school, the state will fund it. in our country, we've got a much tighter control over schools that do receive state funding. I'll come back to the RE issue in a moment, but certainly all schools that receive state funding have to teach the national curriculum, have to show that they can enable their students to attain in terms of SATs, in terms of GCSEs and so on, and they're all inspected. So there is quite a tight control over what a school with a religious foundation actually, that receives state funding is actually doing. I think it's often one that's thrown at church schools and other faith schools that, you know, they're getting their own kind of education on the state. Well, as I said, in the first place, those parents are paying taxes. I think to suggest that religious people don't pay their taxes and don't make a contribution is perhaps a little naive.
Well, I didn't suggest that. But in addition, paying taxes. Say they don't want it.
No, exactly,
more.
And that's, I mean, yes. We could have another discussion about that. But in addition, the religious groups are putting a huge amount of money in. Just to speak from my own denomination, from the Church of England, the schools were actually provided by the church in the first place, long before the state actually accepted it had any need to provide education for the masses, the churches, the Christian denominations, realised the need and actually set about putting their hands in the pockets to build schools and pay for teachers to meet those needs. And those needs were in the rapidly growing industrial centres of this country, where life for the working classes and those that didn't work was nasty, brutish and short. And children were part of the industrial workforce, so they were down the mines, you know, in the factories, in the mills. And that became a matter of scandal amongst those, mostly, as I say, those that actually did something about it were from the Christian denominations. And their aim was, well, the very earliest...
Most of those who set up schools, yeah, but not most of people who did anything
anything. Well, in terms of, well, yes, in terms of actually knowing, you know, being able to see visible results, you're right that there was a coalition who, in the end, led to the 1870 Act, which was the first time that the state got involved in schools. But from the latter years of the 18th century, it was the Christian groups that said, this is not right.
Does a tradition, though, equal a right then to have a kind of...
I'm still on the actual, the resourcing issue. So by 1850, there were 17,000 Church of England schools. Now, there aren't that many now, but that was the scale. And if we quantified that in today's terms, that would be millions of pounds put in for the education of children who were not necessarily going to turn up in the church on Sunday morning. And that's fairly important for the Church of England schools. These days, in addition to the 10% of the funds that are required for some of the building work that goes on and the care of the building, diocese, church groups through the diocese actually fund all the national support for the Church of England schools, which, again, we're just in the process of collating what that actually amounts to in financial terms. But it's a huge resource that's put there to support the schools, and not just to support the RE and the worship, but to support those schools in giving a good education to the children that go. If come back to the RE just for a moment. Again, that's quite a balance that a school with a religious foundation needs to strike. Where they see their role as predominantly nurture within the faith, so that would go for Jewish schools, for Muslim schools, and to a large extent in public pronouncements for Roman Catholic schools, then inevitably one of the things they're going to want to be delivering through the RE curriculum and the rest is to bring those children up as members of the faith community. The Church of England's slightly different because it's always had a kind of dual focus. Yes, it's there for those that want a Christian education and more specifically an Anglican education, but it's also there for the children who happen to be there. The origins were for those who needed education, whether they went to to the Anglican Church or not. And still today we'd say that the Church of England's role is to be both distinctive and inclusive. So distinctive in that it's offering education with a Christian within a Christian framework, but inclusive in that it's available for all. Now, our problem is we haven't got places for all, and that leads us on to a whole other set of questions.
I mean, but that doesn't compromise, you know, this sense of it being fair and sort of balanced in terms of the way it helps children to think about issues.
In practice, all the major faith groups are signed up to Faith in the System, which was the document that came out last autumn, committing themselves to precisely that, offering that opportunity for their the students in their schools to learn about faiths other than the faith of the school. Now, how that's done does vary, but I know that diocesan syllabuses are all multi-faith now. There will be a balance in favour of Christianity, as indeed agreed syllabuses have to have. And so, for instance, in my former diocese, where at least three primary schools in Manchester, every single child was a Muslim, they would still learn about Christianity, they would still learn about Islam, they'd still learn about the other major faiths as well.
We're just going to give a chance for people, if you'd like to respond to anything you're hearing Jan or Andrew say on the programme today, I'd love to hear your responses, 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5 to leave a voicemail message. Or you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
But there's something beyond just the RE issue here, isn't there, Andrew, which is that you believe it's fundamentally discriminatory to select pupils on the basis of their parents' faith, I suppose, in most cases. I mean, is that a major problem for you?
Well, first of all, on the RE issue, I mean, I don't think that what Jan has said necessarily holds true for all faith schools. I don't think that they all are willing to give that authentic balance in their teaching to all worldviews, and even if they are to religious ones, then certainly not to non-religious ones. And the second thing is that even though one might say, for example, in a Church of England school, a syllabus is balanced, I think there's still a certain skew, as Jan sort of admits, at least there's a focus or a balance in favour of Christianity, and I just don't think that is right in a society where we want to give children absolute rights over their own freedom to believe and access to as much information of different sorts as possible.
But isn't Jan's point that in an instance where it's the parents' desire that the child be brought up in an atmosphere where there is a certain religion, if you like, that is predominant, that's going to be a natural factor in what's being taught?
Well, if that's a parent's wish, then a parent can accomplish this at home or in the community or in the Sunday school, as we were talking about earlier. They don't have to use the public organisations of the state to do so. And I only got halfway through, I suppose, earlier on my discussion of rights. I only sort of got as far as to say that parents' rights don't necessarily have to attract state funding. Also, it would be impossible in practice, of course, to give every group of parents who wanted it a state school. But the important thing about children's rights is that, okay, Jan says that we have a certain custom and practice in this country to disregard children's rights until they are sort of provably competent and mature, and until that point they're a sort of possession of their parent. Well, that may be true, but we're also signed up to international conventions on the rights of the child that say something quite different, that say that children, you know, are individuals with rights that accrue to them as their capacities develop. And that doesn't say that they're tabula rasa, that they're blank slate that have to be then left to their own devices until they're, you know, sufficiently competent enough to make a choice. But it does mean that they have to be given, treated in the context of us knowing that they're going to have that choice. And I would say that means equipping them with as much information as possible in their process of growing up, and not allowing them to be treated as a possession of their parents in the public institutions. I mean, we can't stop, as we said before, we can't stop parents indoctrinating their children in all sorts of ways, beneficial or negative, whatever sort of indoctrination or your point of view is. But we can say that we will not use community assets to do it. There are very good reasons for saying that. We can say because as a community we believe collectively in the rights of the child to make up their own mind in these instances, because we know that there will come a time when they have to make that choice, and we want them to have all the information possible when they make it. As you say about moving on to admissions, which I think is what you mean by, you know, the discrimination in school. No, I mean, I think that we're in a very different context now in this country than we were in the middle of the 19th century or the end of the 18th century when church schools were being set up and when there wouldn't be necessarily anything particularly controversial about saying, here's a school, it's going to be run by the church. It was controversial with some people, but not particularly controversial. But the context is completely changed now, and we're in a society that is diverse in terms of ethnicity, that is diverse in terms of philosophies and beliefs. And I think in that context, it is an obligation really on the community as a whole, in the schools that they provide for the children of society as a whole, to ensure that those children mix together, are prepared within their school for the sort of society they'll go out into. And I think that it's a mistake, therefore, to allow state-funded schools to select pupils on grounds of religion or ethnicity or any of those factors that I think are irrelevant. And although, for example, Roman Catholic schools have a greater ethnic mix than community schools, and some individual Church of England schools, of course, have a greater ethnic mix than some community schools. Nonetheless, one of the mechanisms within our state education system that allows segregation and the building up of communities that are separate from one another is the ability that state-funded faith schools have to select their pupils. And I think we'll see that especially as the diversity of faith schools increases. So as we get Muslim schools, Buddhist schools...
I mean,
schools.
This is one of the issues with this petition and the and the statement it had. It said, towards the end of it, abolishing faith schools will provide children with more freedom of choice and help to promote a fully multicultural, peaceful society. So,
well, not by its own, it won't, but it might be a good step.
That's the point I'd like to come back at. I think it's loading onto schools a responsibility, or it's actually seeing schools as the mechanism for creating and maintaining separateness and separate communities, and that's clearly not true. There are a number of things that just have to be teased out here, I think. One of the things that's absolutely clear is that we are balancing out both those things that we said right at the start, that there are parents who wish their children to be educated within a particular context. And because they make up society, there's no society apart from the people that make it up. Their wishes have to be taken into account, as well as any government's sense that it knows what's best for people. And that's the other thing that always... there's always somebody else who thinks they know better than individual families and parents and people what should happen to them. So that's one thing. How do you build into a system that ability for wish that parents have that their children should be educated in a context within which they're happy and comfortable and that reflect the things that are important to them? I think the key group that's found it really quite difficult have been Muslim families who in schools, in community schools, have felt that their faith is neither understood nor recognised nor taken seriously. And for them, some of the options have only been to seek a place in a Church of England school or a Roman Catholic school, on the grounds that faith is given the kind of prominence and importance that they wish it to have in the lives that they're trying to create for their families and their children. So that's one aspect. The second is that there's just as much selection and discrimination outside the faith school sector. You could take every faith school out of the system and you would still have a deeply divided and segregated school system. And that's divided and segregated on the grounds of class, divided and segregated on the grounds of ability. None of this is allowed within the system, but it happens, and it happens because that's how parents operate the system. The system, even without faith schools, if you consider simply community schools, is non-selective. But parents select the schools. The accusation is made, and again, come back to faith schools, that faith schools select their pupils. Well, actually, they don't, by and large. Such research that there is full of kind of weasel connections that say, because this is what an admissions policy looks like, it could give a governing body the power to select its pupils On grounds that are not appriate.
But schools dissect on religious grounds, don't they?
They certainly... Well, there is, yes, there's the capacity, and that, of course, varies as well. And
but that's the main problem.
Well, but that's... No, but that's the balance we're trying to strike all the time. If parents wish for their child to be educated within a particular context, then the system ought to be able to accommodate that. And that's all that it's doing. It would be quite hard to understand why, for example, a parent who had no interest in faith and no faith background at all would choose a school which was, for instance, a Muslim school.
I mean,
school.
When well, it says that, that abolishing faith schools will provide more freedom of choice, isn't it the opposite way
yes.
around, Andrew? Won't
yes,
it abolish freedom of choice? Because there won't be the choice for parents to have their children brought up in a particular type of environment.
The education system isn't like a supermarket, you know, or a grocer's store. One person's choice is another person's lack of choice, actually. I mean, I'm quite surprised to hear, you know, a representative of the Church of England, which in other parts of the world sort of opposes this sort of marketistic approach to public services and so on, to be promoting it in England, you know, where it clearly stands to the disadvantage of, for a start, people lower down in the socioeconomic scale. However, if you choose, if I say, right, this person in this area, this local area, needs to have the choice of a Hindu and a Buddhist school, so I have a Hindu and a Buddhist school in this area, you know, the people who don't want that school in that area, who want a different school in that area, but when there are only a Hindu and a Buddhist school in that area and no community school, can't choose a community school. Do you see what I mean? That's not very well put. What I'm saying is that if the local school is a Church of England school, and sometimes we're talking about areas where there is only one local school, then where's the choice? There's no choice.
But equally, there's no choice if the only school is a community school without any faith ethos. I suppose
what we should have are different sorts of schools. I'm not sitting here saying the community school system is perfect. I mean, if we got on to discussing the school system as a whole, I'd have a lot to say about the schools we ought to have in society today. Because I think, by the way, that's what we should be talking about. We shouldn't get sort of bogged down in the past and the way things are and say this is just the way things are and the way they have to be. I think when we talk about something as important as the education system, we should talk about what the ideal situation would be. But listen, if a local school was a community school, I think it should certainly be accommodating the religious preferences of people locally in a way that is done well in some schools in Europe, where schools are shared, some countries in Europe where schools are shared, but then religious differences are accommodated within them in terms of various sorts.
Yes, it's not a terribly good record.
It's not universally good.
We've got to go to a quick break now, we'll get back onto the subject in just a short moment. We're talking about faith schools this afternoon here on Unbelievable with Andrew Copson from the British Humanist Association and Jan Ainsworth, Chief Education Officer with the Church of England. And we'll be giving out details for you to get in contact again shortly, so do tune in again in just a couple of minutes' time. Welcome back. Before we hear again from our guests in the studio here, let me tell you that next week you'll be able to hear the final part four of the series American Masters of Apologetics. Joining me on the programme next week is Norman Geisler. He is probably one of the best known and foremost defenders of the Christian faith in the world today. He's co-founder and former dean of Southern Evangelical Seminary. He's author of more than 70 books, and we're going to be looking at his latest one, When Skeptics Ask. It's a handbook on Christian evidences. All sorts of questions in there. Are miracles mythological? Why is Jesus better than other teachers? Where did evil come from? We'll be looking at those and more. It's going to be a fascinating time. An extended interview with Norman Geisler, the same time, 2:30 till 4 o'clock next week.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
As we continue to discuss faith schools, and particularly state-funded faith schools, Reverend Jan Ainsworth is with us, Church of England's Chief Education Officer, and obviously for many, many years now, there has been a relationship between the government and the Church of England in the provision of schools which also have a Christian ethos, and that's something that Andrew Copson from the British Humanist Association, he's their education officer, something he's very concerned about, and they've been campaigning for a long time to see an end to that kind of state funding of schools with a particular sort of faith outlook. We've been talking a bit about whether there's a sense in which segregation happens when we ask that people of a certain faith apply to certain schools. Because, I mean, you can't surely ignore that, Jan, I mean, in general, as much as there is a certain amount of diversity within Church of England schools, most people who do attend are going because they've at least written that they attend the Church of England. And so does it right. form a kind of clique, a kind of community?
It's a very, us against very them? Mixed picture. I mean, let's get the primary sector out of the way first. And the vast majority of Church of England schools are primary schools. So, and the vast majority of those function as neighbourhood schools. So they are in the whole mix of schooling within the local area. And what will distinguish them from community schools by and large, because it won't be their admissions. There are very few outside London. London's a bit of a special case, but outside London there aren't that many that are so oversubscribed that they actually apply the Christian criteria. Most of the voluntary aided admissions policies will have that as a criterion, but the vast majority of them won't apply it. So it's the same mix of children as you get, as you would expect from where the school is located. And the distinctiveness generally lies in close ties with the parish. So the local vicar will have a role within the school, either taking assemblies or and on the governing body. And in a voluntary aid school, they may well, again, teach the diocesan syllabus for religious education. But again, that mix can be very can be extraordinary. Schools that have, you know, vast number of mother tongues spoken in the schools and the full range of religious backgrounds, or the little village school, which simply reflects the village that within which it's situated, where it might be completely monoethnic and no representatives from other cultures there, though that's increasingly rare wherever you go in Britain. Mm. So the primary sector is different, and of course half our primary schools are voluntary controlled, which means they have exactly the same admissions policy as the neighbourhood, as the community schools. The issues are much more critical around the secondary sector, and we recognise this. And one of the reasons is that some Church of England secondary schools actually are very high-performing schools for a whole range of reasons, and we have some data as to why that happens, and we need a lot more. So inevitably, any high-performing school then attracts the sort of parents that want that kind of education for their children. If it happens to be a Church of England school, they will make sure that they can fulfil the religious requirements. If it happens to be a community school, they'll move house to make sure they're in the right catchment area. So there will always be parents who can manipulate the system. And that is regrettable. It's not how we would want it to be. And one of the ways in which we're trying to change that is to continue to apply pressure to encourage governing bodies to allocate a certain number of places
call it
that don't go on.
Parents manipulating the system. But I can imagine a situation in which a parish priest might be quite pleased if a pair of parents
yes.
turn up at his church yes. more often than they normally
Some
would
of them
because
quite a blessed nuisance.
Well, okay, maybe
but
they
no,
do,
no, you're
but,
right. But, you're right.
But I mean,
and obviously, if
surely that's
if
the way that
it
works
to do
a bit
for
isn't
a long
it?
Way, a long time. Then you know, my reply to clergy who moan that they only get parents turning up because they want the child to get into the school is saying, "Well, what are you doing with them when you've got them there? This is your opportunity to engage them in that kind of discussion that will help them on their life's journey, whether they end up, you know, still being a part of the electoral role and on the worship roster is another issue. That's, you know, we'd say that's in God's hands as much as anything else. But
again, I mean, you would see that sort of symbiosis, Andrew, as something that is bad, because it's kind of, if you like, using education
yeah.
to draw
to
adults into
yeah.
the church. It's a kind of unfair use of a...
You can only do that if the school's worth it. I mean, it's, you know,
it's not going to work with a failing school.
No, it isn't.
That's right.
That's
failing school equals failing church. But I mean, moving away from the church context into other sorts of religious schools, I think there you do have even more difficulties, because when you've got this pattern of saying, in order to gain entry to church school, you have to demonstrate a church commitment in one way or another. Well, you know, the Church of England is sort of lucky. Well, it's not lucky, it's because it was there first, and so it got to set the pattern in being able to say, here is an easy test, sort of a worship test. Are you there? Are you not? Fine. Then, you know, you qualify. Other religions don't have that. And I think that as other religions open their schools, we're going to see more and more bizarre admissions policies, like the Hare Krishna school that's just opened and really got into trouble because they tried to find an analogue for the Church of England missions procedure, and ends up saying, well, we'll only let in, you know, for a certain number of places, Hindus, I think they said Hindus rather than Hare Krishnas, Hindus, and we need a religious test, so our test will be, are you teetotal, are you vegetarian, do you, you know, do all these things. So they had to evolve this complicated... It was the same with a Sikh school that ended up saying, well, our test will be, do you do these duties in temple? Unfortunately, one of the duties happened to be giving money, so it ended up that they were effectively charging for admission and had to change it. But all this sort of struggle for admission is all because, I would say, because a religious test is being applied to admission to a state school, and it shouldn't be, not just because it's wrong in principle, but because actually in practice it lays the whole system open to quite a bit of abuse, and is not also... doesn't have the clarity that a parent should be able to expect from the state-provided education system.
I think some of the... I mean, this is a dilemma that particularly the newer schools with a religious foundation are having to work through. And it is a genuine dilemma, I think, because Andrew's right, that it, you know, other faiths function in different ways. Certainly when some of the Church of England schools that were allocating places for children from other faith communities found that they couldn't read across at all what, you know, for the Church of England is about attendance at worship, and tended to leave it very much to the religious authority, the minister, the clergy, the imam, or to actually simply attest to the... But it is tricky and it is difficult. But that doesn't mean to say it shouldn't happen. There's a recurring issue at the moment around the whole business of ethos and how far those who apply to a school with a religious foundation should be asked to support the ethos. Now, some of it's come up through the scrutiny of admissions policies. And again, it's about balance. Certainly, head teachers of Church of England schools would say that, and of any school, that for the school to succeed, for children to succeed within a school, there needs to be a commitment, a common commitment to what the school stands for and how things will be done. And that applies just as well in community schools as it does in schools with a religious foundation, because it's the ethos that drives, you know, how those children do succeed within the school and how they attain and how they grow and learn. So commitment to the religious foundation of the school is something that is important, because why would you want to go if you're hostile to it anyway? And how can the school function if...
Some people don't want to go, of course, and end up just having to go. I mean, you know, at the British Humanist Association, we do get, requests from advice for parents who... can't get into their local school because it's a faith school and they want to. But we also get requests for advice and guidance from people whose only school is, a church school. They don't want to send their child necessarily, but they end up having to because they can't, drive out or bus out to another area. So, I mean, I think that this is really...
For parents in that situation, are there exemption policies where they can take children out of religious worship?
Yes, there's certainly the withdrawal from religious education and worship. And that does happen, and the schools... make provision for the children who are withdrawn. And that is a legal protection of every parent in every school in the country, whether it's got a religious foundation or not. If it's state-funded, then that's there for everyone. And some schools, again, in the past, this has been one of the things the admissions code tried to... Some schools tried to say, well, if you come here, you can't withdraw from Aryan worship. And actually, you can. That's a legal right for every parent. But you're right. It's not an ideal solution. I can't understand now, given that religious education is... broadly understood to be about learning about the range of faiths and learning to work within, if you like, a faith context and understand how it works and to grapple with the ideas. Why we need the withdrawal from RE. I mean, I hear what Andrew's saying, but I think the
most people
the
who withdraw from RE don't withdraw from RE because they're not religious.
No,
they withdraw from RE because they're
Jehovah's
religious.
Witnesses,
yeah,
yes.
I mean there are Christians and Muslim Jehovah's Witnesses who withdraw their children because they don't like their children learning about other religions, and that I think is the reason why people withdraw from RE. It's not humanists withdrawing from RE. They're by and large happy to have their children learn about religions and non-religious worldviews as well, not just faiths.
What's the situation, you can bring me up to speed here, with whether schools have a religious foundation or not, the requirements on them to have some kind of act of religious worship, broadly based in Christian based in character. I mean, is that a requirement for every school?
And I suppose it's one of the ways in which we do betray our origins, the origins of the education system. The Christian churches are still very much committed to that for all children.
And everyone else is against it.
Well, you say everyone else is against it?
Well, in the the public is very much against it. There was a 1998 consultation and everyone was against it in terms of the National Parent Teachers Association, National Governors Association, every teaching union has policy against it. Hindu Council, Sikh Education Council, Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is, British Humanist Association, everyone was in favour of a reform of that to end worship and introduce a new requirement for assemblies that would assist spiritual, moral, social, cultural development, apart from the Church of England, the Roman Catholic Church.
No, the Muslim
Association schools.
Yes.
That's right, they were the three.
All the Christian churches, yes.
They were the three. No, at that point, the Methodist and the Christian Council all said, it's only since then that they've all got into a huddle.
Yes, churches together
produced.
In England, yes.
And that's unfortunate. It's unfortunate to see some Christian churches, which used to have a commitment to inclusive assemblies, to let it go in order to get together with the Church of England to maintain a legal requirement for worship. I regret that. And it's a sad fact about some of the dissenting and reform denominations that they've done that. But
Is it unfair? I mean, as far as you're concerned, Jan, or is there a good reason to keep this age-old institution?
There's always a negotiation with how you understand what activities actually entail, and there's been a great shift in an understanding what worship in school might look like as opposed to worship in temple, mosque or synagogue. And one of the focuses around which a lot of that discussion and change has taken place is the idea of spiritual development. And I think that's where the churches would want to stake a claim that for all societies, in all places, at all times, until really very recently, that's been expressed through, or one of the major routes for spiritual development has been through involvement in worship. Now, clearly, that's changed over the last, I would have thought 3 or 4 decades as our populations in schools have changed. And what was the usual offering, the kind of hymn prayer sandwich, has changed out of all recognition. And particularly, the shift from prayer as a key component to prayer stroke reflection is one that I think's shown how the negotiation, the discussion and the fitting to context for the traditional school worship has taken place, so that what happens in school worship is an invitation rather than a compulsion. Now, we think it's still important because there is no other way in which children can, unless they're within a faith context, can experience, can encounter what worship for religious people is like.
Yes, there is. And they can visit places of worship.
No, because that doesn't involve them in taking part.
So people have to participate in worship.
Encounter is the word that we would use.
Can't they encounter it in a visit to a place of worship?
Because most places of worship won't lay on an act of worship for a totally disparate group of people.
Oh.
And school is one of the places where you would be able to explore the different aspects. I think schools are very careful, particularly controlled schools, Church of England controlled schools, and particularly VA primary schools, to allow the space that enables the children who are taking part to understand that this is something that belongs to some people and not to others, but there are things that all people can benefit from.
And going back to what you were saying about there is no such thing as a neutral environment in which to bring up children in that sense.
And no one claims there is, by the way.
Okay, but good. I mean, if you're asking Andrew
for... It can be an objective environment.
If you're asking...
That assumes you've got some place out there that you can stand and look down on everything else. And
no, it doesn't.
Everybody comes within a position...
But aren't you asking, Andrew, for assemblies which basically get rid of, if not mentions of God, belief in God being present in that assembly. And so from that point of view...
What do you mean?
Well, I'm saying... You're saying, OK, you're happy for children to be told about religion, uh-huh. but you're not happy for them to be in an environment
to be made
where...
To pray,
where there is an opportunity for actual participation, practice, or as you call it, engagement, Jan, with that religious... And from that point of view... are we kind of taking away any options from...
I think the opportunity or encounter and all these other phrases that are used are weasel words in this context. It is not the case that they all have children who think, oh, I might, you know, today I'm going to be offered the opportunity to pray and offered the opportunity to worship. Now, that may happen in some schools, but in fact it's rather like the Pledge of Allegiance in the United States of America. You know, every day, every school is meant to have the Pledge of Allegiance, and every child has the right... not to say it. But there's very large amount of difference between a teacher, for example, saying, now we will recite the Pledge of Allegiance. US law gives you the opportunity to opt out. Now everyone stand and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. And a teacher who might say, we now recite, those who wish to will now recite the Pledge of Allegiance. America has a long tradition of liberty of thought. And so if you don't want to say it, sit down. Those who wish to now rise. And I think that's the sort of situation that we're in with worship, potentially.
And that couldn't be further from what's actually going on in schools, actually.
I've seen that in schools.
Well, having inspected both community schools and Church of England schools for a long time, it isn't actually the common pattern. And what pupils report, when certainly in inspections nowadays, is that the assemblies, the worship they like best is that which makes them think.
The assemblies and, they like best.
It depends what the school calls it. I mean, it is worship in law, but it depends what the school calls it. And the ones they like best and the ones they remember are the ones that make them think. So I'm quite confident that within the Christian framework which Church of England schools operate within, I'm not saying so much for community schools because I think there's a lot more dissatisfaction and therefore that means that they're less comfortable
Jan and I are both put on the back foot, in a sense, by the law in this area, by the fact that it requires, you know, collective worship of our broadly, what is it? Daily collective worship, wholly or mainly of a broadly Christian character. That's what the law requires. And I think that both what Jan and I both might agree on is that there should be assemblies that offer an opportunity for pupils to reflect, to come together and to reflect on big issues, ultimate questions, and also to sort of celebrate the shared life of the school and of humanity, if that's not too highfalutin. I don't think it is. Now, within that context, there may be opportunities for children to hear from or experience worship activities from a range of different religions, and I would be perfectly comfortable with that sort of scenario.
What I think would be lost would be any commitment to doing any of that, because if you
it's
think
not
about
at the moment,
well,
in
yes,
most schools.
No, I can only say from the inspection evidence that actually it is happening. That
well, it only
the good,
happens on the day of the inspection.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Not the way the inspections work at the moment. What would be lost would be any sense of how any of that is informed by faith. I mean, we're clearly committed within the Church of England sector to enabling children and students to become part of that, in the sense that that's how the school works, whilst still understanding that part of the process of doing it and through the lessons is to critique and scrutinise it. And I think what happens in community schools actually can sometimes be inspired and inspiring.
I think,
but
often
most of the time it's banal.
I think community school assemblies, especially through the government SEAL programme, are just incredible. I mean, I've seen some assemblies where children children have really engaged. They're obviously, I mean, no, far more than, you know, some Christian assemblies that I've seen. But I think that, in a sense, you're defending something simply because it happens to exist. I mean, what would you feel about constructing an argument from scratch that there should be worship of a holy many Christian character? I mean, what would be required?
What would be lost?
Most pupils aren't religious,
no, no.
For a start.
What would be lost?
Why shouldn't there be encountering atheists?
One of the things it encapsulates is that there needs to be more than the academic study that religious education provides. So this is the opportunity to inhabit particular practices, particular ways of understanding the world, particular ways of organising one's own inner life that would actually be lost, I think. I mean, there's some good practice in RE, particularly in the kind of reflective practices and so on, which again, you know, are slightly incoherent if they don't have a kind of particular faith context.
Oh, that's so insulting. It's such an insult, it really is, to say from a sort of established tradition, do you know what, anything you practice or dabble in is just vacuous without a root in our foundation.
I'm happy to explore the role of crystals in my inner life, but I just don't think it's got much mileage.
We're going to have to wrap things up here, but thank you both for just a really interesting discussion. I mean, we could keep going for ages on all sorts of different areas, but it certainly got me thinking about the value of worship in school settings, how much we should be, if you like, giving children options to engage with these sorts of areas, and how much of that might be seen as indoctrination, you know, by someone like Andrew. If you want to get in touch, let me just remind once more before we have to wrap things up, the number 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. And if you'd like to email, that's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Ultimately, Andrew, I went to a Church of England school, and I think I've grown up as a pretty sane, rational person. I am a Christian, but you know that I wouldn't.
That.
apart from that,
otherwise you're fine.
The point is, these schools aren't breeding sort of misfits or people who can't deal with the world in a kind of rational way. And most people would say, well, what's the big problem here? You know, it's not. You know, they're doing a good job. Why change something that's working as it stands?
Well, I think that when you look at the education system, you should ask yourself what is best for the society that we're in today, what is best to help young people grow up to live in the society that they'll be in the future. And I have yet to hear an argument that persuades me that it is a good idea to allow our schools to separate children on the grounds of religion, to allow our schools not to teach broadly and objectively about a range of different religions, but to teach only one, or that one is true, or to employ only teachers of a certain religion. I've yet to hear any argument that sort of state-funded faith school will be what's needed for a future society. And we're not just talking about church schools, of course. There are church schools that are effectively community schools or operate as them. I would want to hear arguments why church schools were good for society, and why faith schools of all different sorts were good for society, rather than just why they're not that bad.
Okay, in a nutshell, give us why you think that is the case, that they are good for society, Jan, and we're going to have to end there.
Partly because we need to enable young people to understand their own cultural history and understand the history of the place where they're growing up. And one of the things that does that is to enable the framework to influence the whole of the whole of the education that's being offered. There are, I hear what Andrew's saying, the whole business about whether they're discriminatory or segregatory is one aspect of them, but it's not the only aspect. And I suppose what we'd want to say is that in the end, our fundamental assumptions about the nature of knowledge, what is good knowledge, what knowledge you need and what you need to grow up, the nature of personhood and the nature of society and what's important for society is more than just religious education and worship. It actually does need to permeate the whole of the school, because what the different faiths, what the Church of England would say and what the Christians would say, is that there are things about the Christian faith which are necessary for the country as it develops, that they're necessary correctives to the way in which the society is developing and growing, and that one of the ways to make sure that has some impact, whether or not we turn out people who go to church every week, is to do it through the schools.
Thank you so much for joining me, both on the programme today, and thank you for listening. And if you'd like to listen back, this programme is going to be available online as usual, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Well, it's time to tell you what's coming up next week on the programme.
You're unbelievable.
Do join me at the same time next week, 2.30 till 4 o'clock. We finish our American Masters of Apologetics after our short break this week, as we have with us Norman Geisler, who is probably one of the foremost defenders of the Christian faith today, looking at his new book, When Skeptics Ask, asking questions like, does God exist? What if he's not all-powerful? Where did evil come from? Are miracles mythological? Why is Jesus better than other teachers? Well, if anyone's the man to help us understand this, it's Norman, and you'll find out why next week between 2.30 and 4 o'clock. Don't forget to visit us online as well and listen back to this and other programmes. premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.